Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, I'll call you as soon as the show's over.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us through tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio. Coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Now, the show is simulcast on Omega Television Network, which is, you can access it by going to kenhudnall.com. There's a monitor in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. In the center of the homepage, there is a player that you can click on and listen to the show. Normally on Thursday nights, we have Robert McKnight, but like so many people I know, he seems to be a little under the weather today. So instead, we're going to talk about some of the strangeness that makes this country so unique. Now, this hour is brought to you by Marcello's Ristorante Italiano, two locations, 1360 Lee Trevino in the Sun Point Shopping Center, and 5380 North Mesa in the Festival Crossing Shopping Center. Both have the ambiance of old Italy, and some of the best Italian food you ever put in your mouth. They have all types of pastas, vegetarian plates, fish, lamb, chicken, and veal. A number of folks I know have gone there and said they absolutely love the food. Now, you know, there are a number of stories that have made the rounds. As I've gone around the country, I've collected stories of all kinds of strange and unusual things. When I was in Las Vegas, some of the stories that were discussed absolutely would boggle your mind. And they were treated as if they were the most common everyday things you can imagine. Now, one of the stories came from an individual. Now, in case of these type of stories, nobody ever says, I was there. They always had a relative or a friend who was involved. However, after hearing this particular story, I checked with the management of the hotel I was staying at, and they confirmed that, in fact, they had been made aware that such a thing had happened in another hotel. Now, the story has a number of variations, but the basic premise of the story, a newly married couple had checked in for their honeymoon. Now, in some cases, the story says they got married there in Vegas because there's wedding chapels everywhere. You can even be married by Elvis. And in another version of the story, they came to Vegas simply for the honeymoon. Now, what was so amusing about the whole thing? Apparently, this was not the most adventurous couple that had ever come down the pike. In fact, they had both saved themselves for their wedding night. And they were going to have an evening of unbelievable bliss and excitement. So the eager husband, according to the way the story was told to me, and the young man that told it to me, I say young, he had been working in Vegas hotels for over 50 years. But he was a man of great energy. And he said the husband had swept his wife off her feet and carried her across the threshold. And the hotel had given him complimentary champagne, as befitting a wedding night. So they, one glass led to another, and pretty much, Elves or Elvis, you can get married by either one. In Vegas, you can get married by my mother-in-law. Oh, heaven help us. You know, I know what's happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but there are many people I know who wish their mother-in-law would stay in Vegas and away from them. Anyway, this couple, leaving a trail of clothes behind them, that took to the marriage bed, and a bit of trial and error became... took place. Apparently he needed a road map, and while she knew the way, she didn't know the destination, apparently. But anyway, the next morning, after an evening of connubial bliss, we have Catstar 66 from Australia with us. How y'all doing? And Gwyneth is here under the name of Lane W. One of those is her nom de plume. Anyway, the next morning they notice an odd odor in the room. Now, that night, the night before, they wouldn't have noticed a bomb going off in the room. But they noticed the odor. And they called housekeeping and then they left to enjoy each other's company around the great city of Las Vegas. Now, when they came back to their room that late that afternoon for another evening of connubial bliss, the odor they had detected early that morning was now just a flat-ass stink. The maid apparently hadn't found what was causing the smell. So the newlyweds decided they were going to track it down. And they moved couches and they moved dressers, and finally, process of elimination, they tracked it down to the bed. So each one grabbed an end of the mattress and they heaved it off the bed, and there in a compartment that had been cut into the box springs was a corpse. Now, there are those that would say this is an urban legend, but a little bit of research showed that such a thing had happened in Atlantic City, but no one could tell me specifically what hotel in Vegas. But, you know, when you're lost on a trip and you got enough to worry about trying to find your destination, you don't need these little side interruptions. And I'm sure Romeo could have done without the body. Now, I'm working on a book, and a lot of the stories are coming from the book that I put together. It's called The History and Mystery of Sin City, and that will be the next book that will come out in the Spirits of the Border series. And there's a story that made the rounds in Vegas. Now, you can hear almost anything you want to hear, no question about it. And, you know, all over the state of Nevada, there are caves. And there are many, many stories of spirits and portals to other worlds that have been associated with some of these caves. And some of these stories actually have been told since before Europeans ever came to that part of the West. Now, there's a place called Cave Valley. And in Cave Valley, there is, of course, a cave. It's located near the Utah border. There was a Mormon explorer named George Washington Bean who found a cavern back in the 1800s and discovered, according to him, thousands of footprints and other signs of human occupation. The local Indians said it was off limits. They had been long told surprisingly enough, Lane has not visited any cemeteries in Las Vegas, nor gambled. My goodness. Oh, we have Sapphire Rain has joined us. Well, how are you? And John from Tucson is with us. My goodness. It's almost Old Home Week. It's always nice to have you all with me. Now, according to the local Native Americans, may see the ghost of my liver in Vegas. I drank too much. Well, I understand that it may be hanging out. Over at the International. My goodness, I got all kinds of things going on here. Now, according to the local tribes, a number of years before George Washington Bean put in an appearance, two women had entered the cave and remained there for well over 6 months. And when they came back, they were wearing different clothing, new clothing, and had quite a story to tell. Now, the local Native Americans never said who these two women were that I'm aware of. But they said deep inside the cave, they found a valley. It was filled with vegetation, animals, water, and a tribe of people. And according to the local Indians, that tribe that lived in that cavern were responsible for the tracks that Dean had found. Now, near the Cave Valley Cave, if you will, there is also the Cave Creek Cave. And it's another one that is said to be haunted. In fact, it's haunted by a Civil War soldier. Now, in Nevada, during the Civil War, there was a Fort Ruby. And Fort Ruby had quite a reputation. As being one of the most boring places on the planet. While there was Confederate activity in Nevada, it was nowhere near Fort Ruby. Now, in 1865, half a dozen soldiers stationed at Fort Ruby decided to explore the cave. And finding that most of it was full of water because the creek flowed right through the middle of it, they built a boat and decided to see if they could navigate the water system. And they paddled along the creek for about 500 yards before it was stopped by a wall of rock. And the water went underneath the rocks. So one of the soldiers dove in to try to see if he could swim underneath the rocks that were blocking the way. And he was gone for several minutes, and then his corpse floated to the surface. Now, it doesn't say what happened to the other five, but I suspect with one dead, that kind of put a damper on their enthusiasm. But the Eureka Daily Sentinel, in June of 1887, published a letter from a man named Baker, who said that after hearing the story, he decided to explore the cave himself. And he went in and he found the soldier's boat where they had left it. He arrived at the wall where the water went underneath. And while he was deciding what to do, the ghost of the dead soldier appeared in front of him. Now, according to what the ghost is said to have told Baker, and apparently there was no relation between Baker and the soldier, the soldier had actually come there to commit suicide, but he wanted it to look like an accident so that any benefits accruing to his family wouldn't be interfered with by the fact that he had committed suicide. And the reason that he was so despondent and wanted to end his own life was a love affair with a young lady who lived near the fort that hadn't gone too well. Now, you can believe Baker or not, it doesn't really make any difference. You might go in and try for yourself. The cave is apparently not hard to find. There have been several explorations since Baker's experience. In 1939, searchers found a small figurine of a Chinese idol at the very spot where the soldier took his life. A 1981 exploration found the idol. And as soon as they got near it, because you can only get to it by going down the creek inside the cave. As soon as they got close to the idol, their raft deflated, which could be something of a problem. Now, if you go there, the last time people tried to get into it, it was blocked by bars. But that doesn't mean that it's permanently closed. Now, you know, it's interesting that there's several traditions in Nevada that I heard about that I found interesting. In Reno, there is a divorce tradition. Now, Reno's long been known for quickie divorces. And some traditions have grown up around these divorces that might be interesting for you to hear about. One tradition starts right at the front door of the courthouse. It's the Washoe County Courthouse. It's said that by kissing a pillar after obtaining a divorce, a newly single person ensures a more successful marriage the second time around. It was actually published in Life magazine in 1937. See, Reno was made famous by all the stars. Let's see. John from Tucson says, my sound got hacked. I got a laugh instead of sound. No, I didn't. However, with Blog Talk, you never know what's going to happen next. It's never a dull moment. And Chaska has joined us. Now, a lot of people after the divorce have to wonder what to do with the wedding ring. Reno has the answer. You walk a block from the courthouse to the Virginia Street Bridge, and you throw your ring into the Truckee River. Now, nobody knows when this tradition started, but apparently it's been around for as long as anybody can remember. Of course, it's helped along by those who spend their early hours of the morning exploring the banks of the Truckee underneath the bridge with a metal detector. And there have been some good-sized diamonds found in the river. Now, when you discuss whether or not we went to the moon, Nevada is right there in almost any discussion that you want to make. Now, Bill Kaysing wrote a book. Well, we've talked about it. It's called We Never Went to the Moon, and it was published in 1974. And it turns out that in several polls that were taken, a large percentage of the American population doesn't believe we went to the moon either. There are many who believe it was a made-for-TV production. Used to do divorces in a balloon. What'd you do, pitch one of them over the side? That makes sense. And whoever's left could claim the insurance as well. That's a hell of a divorce. Well, Kaysing basically put into writing what a lot of people are already thinking. There's a scene in the James Bond movie, Diamonds Are Forever, released in 1971, where Bond infiltrates a secret space research facility outside Vegas, and while running away from the bad guys, two go up, I come down, whoever paid me more. Hey, I like that. That's a good attitude. And while fleeing the pursuers, he finds himself on a soundstage with a simulated moonscape and astronauts. If you remember the movie, Bond steals their moon vehicle and escapes into the Nevada desert. Now, there are a number of isolated places in Nevada that would be perfect for something like that. Area 51 is certainly a possibility. There's a number of top-secret programs that take place at that hidden base. Now, I took a busload of people there back in 1989, and I was not aware how many people really wanted to go to Area 51. I was asked by Billy Goodman, who used to do a show on KVEG out of Las Vegas, and he wanted me to bring a busload of people over and meet him at the Vortex, which is a very mysterious area in western Nevada. And he called me on Saturday, wanted me to come the following Friday. Well, I arranged for a 44-person bus, and I announced on my show that Monday, if the bus was full, we would leave at $100 a head. If the bus wasn't full, we weren't going. And I figured if I got 44 people together on that bus, I'd be doing something really great. Well, I had to turn away quite a number of people. We filled the bus. And we went to Rachel, Nevada, population 6. Now, Rachel, Nevada, if you blink, you're going to miss it. In fact, had we not seen the sign, you're now leaving Rachel, Nevada, we would have missed it. The Little Alien was the main business in town in 1989. And they had what they laughingly called the what do they call it? The Rachel Hilton, which were six travel trailers scattered around the desert that had been made into places for people to stay. Now, all but two people on the trip absolutely loved roughing it. Two people wanted an honest-to-God Hilton. So I had to have somebody drive them into Vegas and drop them off. They certainly were not happy. Now, the astronauts did some training at the Nevada test site. The first training mission was in February of 65. Now, at least that is what's given for public consumption. But if you'll recall, there was a movie called Capricorn 1 where the moon mission was faked because they knew they would never survive. Is it possible? Almost every hotel in Vegas has stories of hauntings. The old MGM Grand, which has now moved to a different location, there's another hotel that has taken that spot. It covered a city block. And on the corner was a diner. And the diner was actually part of the casino hotel complex. And beneath the diner was a huge tank. Where they got the propane for the and gas for the all the different restaurants and what have you throughout the hotel complex. And something caused a spark. And it exploded. Now, this was early in the morning. And Vegas literally never sleeps. It was about 3 or 4 in the morning. The casino was still going. There were still people there. And a fireball ripped through the diner into the casino and literally incinerated everybody on the ground floor. Well, the MGM Grand was decorated by folks from Hollywood, so they used a lot of plastic in the decorations. Well, when plastic burns, it gives off a toxic gas that got up into the air conditioning system, and a lot of people died in their beds. A number of people reacted to the alarm and tried to get out the fire exits, only to find that the door on the ground level was locked. You needed a key to open it. And they were found kind of piled up near the door. They had suffocated in the fumes. Well, though a lot of the topography inside the rebuilt hotel was different, the casino was pretty much in the same location. And at night, security watches as figures materialize in front of some of the slot machines. And then when they leave, they walk through a solid wall where there used to be a door. If you ever get the opportunity to go, ask where the MGM Grand used to be and go check it out. And then, of course, there is Bugsy Siegel's ghost who haunts the garden behind the Flamingo. Let's see. Can two come up and none come down? Well, certainly that's definitely a possibility. Now, you know, there are lost cities all over the world. Colonel Percy Fawcett died searching for a lost city of gold in South America. But in the fall of 1924, which was about the same time that they were searching for Fawcett and his missing expedition, one of the most important archaeological finds in North American history was discovered in the southern Nevada desert, near a place called Overton. Two brothers were prospecting for gold in a remote area and happened upon the remnants of a lost civilization. Percy just disappeared, never found a body. That is totally correct. However, a number of years later, what was supposed to be his grandson was brought to a British embassy in one of the countries, I don't remember which one. And according to the story, his Percy's son and a native princess, basically the daughter of the ruler, got it on, and when it came time for Percy and his son to move on, Daddy wasn't having any of it. Now, these two men got word to the governor about what they found, and of course, the governor had a special interest in Nevada's ancient history, and you realize how important this could be, not only to archaeology, but to the state of Nevada. So worldwide attention was focused on Nevada and the Lost City. In fact, this Lost City actually extends for about 30 miles, which is the length of the Muddy River. It's believed to date from 1500 to 2000 BC. And the archaeologist who did the first dig, his name was Harrington, discovered a complex of 46 prehistoric structures. The largest had over 100 rooms. Now, he decided it had been built by Puebloan Indians who'd come from the northeast Arizona. The what became known as the Lost City Complex eventually had over 100 buildings in it. It's about 6 miles square, a huge city. And if you ever go to Overton, there's the Lost City Museum, which you might check out. But keep in mind one thing. It's been discovered that a lot of dating of ancient remains are done based upon the preconceived notion that there was nobody on this continent prior to a certain date, that everybody came over on the land bridge, the Bering Strait land bridge, which has been shown more and more not to be true because they can't even prove the land bridge ever existed. Now, there's also been a story that was researched and championed by a man named Captain Alan LeBaron. He went into that same part of Nevada and came away believing the human race actually originated in the American Southwest. Now, interestingly enough, it's been determined that the Incas may actually have had their beginning north of El Paso at Waco Tanks. And as a result of disease, they left and headed south and eventually wound up in Peru. Now, there's been quite a number of ruins found in the American Southwest. clearly it was a well-populated area. Look at the Anasazi. No one really knows who they were, but they had a hell of a civilization. You know, LeBaron did a lot of exploration in Nevada. In fact, from 1912 to about 1930, he was doing an expedition every year, and he literally put the Nevada desert under a magnifying glass. In a place called Grapevine Canyon, he found rocks covered with strange images. They found 1920, some of the headlines from the 20s, absolutely would do justice to the front page of the National Enquirer. But according to LeBaron, there were quite a number of tombs found. And the certainly a great deal of what many people would call treasure. Now, you know, there's been more discoveries made by amateurs than ever has been or ever will be by professional geologists and archaeologists. It was an amateur by the name of Albert Knapp who was strolling through Fisher Canyon in the Humboldt Mountains back in 1927 when he came upon a strange fossil. And this fossil was the imprint from the heel of a shoe and what appeared to be the shoe's leather, one more time, remnants were thoroughly petrified. Now the interesting thing is this shoe is supposed to date from the time of the dinosaurs, because in that same fossilized area were the tracks of creatures that died out at the end of the dinosaur period. Did man coexist with dinosaurs? Certainly, that would make for an interesting discussion. The mysteries of Nevada certainly would boggle the mind. Amateurs are not bound by teaching and therefore see things as they are and not what traditional teachers say. You're absolutely right, John. You know, there's been a bit of an argument over who actually discovered America. Now, of course, the Italians hold out for Columbus. There's now a lot of evidence that the Vikings beat Columbus here. We also know that there were Jewish merchants, there were Romans. Hell, there was a Roman colony right outside of what's now Tucson. But in August of 1925, the director of the Chinese Information Service in Paris announced that America had been discovered by the Chinese in 458 A.D., Now, there was a written account called The History of the Liang Dynasty, written by a Buddhist missionary. And this missionary, Hu Sin, traveled across what was called the Eastern Sea to a place he called Fusang, and he stayed for 40 years. Now, what sea is east of China but the Pacific? Now, there was a book published in 1953 by an attorney out of Chicago by the name of Mertz, who laid the story out in great detail. And I've tried to track the book down, and so far I have not been successful, but I'm still looking. And the she claims that Hushin described in his writings a trip from that began in what is now Washington State and went to Nevada. Now, if in fact the Chinese did explore Nevada in ancient times, that would explain why there's been ancient Chinese writing found at various places in the state. Near Virginia City and near Ely and Searchlight, Nevada, there have been rock carvings in ancient Chinese. Chinese coins have been found. Chinese inscriptions of their value have been found all over Nevada and California. So unless some coin collector went on a spree of scattering the coins, it looks like there may be some basis to it. Many stories talk about ancient peoples having red hair. In fact, then the Nephilim, who were said to be giants, are described by many ancient writings as having red hair. And the reason I bring that up is there was a mining engineer by the name of John Reed, who was also a self-taught archaeologist, and he lived in Lovelock, Nevada in its early days. In 1866, when he was 11 years old, he was on a cattle run with some other boys, including Natchez, who was the son of one of the Indian chiefs. And they camped outside a Lovelock cave. But the Indians wouldn't enter the cave because they feared evil spirits. But they did tell Reed the story about the cave that had been passed down through their tribe. And it makes for a fascinating story. Now, Sarah Winnemucca wrote a book called Life Among the Paiutes, Their Wrongs and Claims. Now, Sarah Winnemucca was descended from Chief Winnemucca, who was Natchez's father. And according to the Paiutes, there was a small tribe of what they call barbarians. Used to live along the Humboldt River. And this was eons before these boys camped outside the cave. And they used to kidnap Indian braves and Indian women and cook and eat them. And there are many stories told by some of the Indian tribes on the West Coast of the fact that giant red-haired people used to live many places around the country, and that they were cannibalistic. So certainly it fit in with what she wrote in her book. But the Indians finally had enough of it, and they trapped them in the cave, in Lovelock Cave, and gave them the opportunity to walk the straight and narrow or die, and they refused to give up their way, so the cave was, the entrance was filled over and set on fire. And after the fire went out, no more red-haired giants. In 1911, Reed, along with a man named David Pugh, formed the Sunset Guano Mining Company. Bat guano used to be very valuable, and Lovelock Cave was full of it. In fact, we used to ship it to other countries before it went to Congress. And they hauled out carloads of guano because the cave had never been lined. And then they began to find artifacts, including human bones and mummified bodies. Now, they got the University of California involved, and they said they found feather boas and other artifacts, as well as that some human skeletons. And in the north end of the cave, they even found some mummified bodies. All of them had red hair. One was 6 foot 6 inches tall. And quite a number of archaeological examinations were done. And it was clear there had been a, according to the findings, there had been a massive fire in the cave. And there was evidence there had been a battle. Now, Reed theorized, based on all this evidence and the stories he'd been told by Natchez, that the Southwest was once inhabited by a race of red-haired giants who had advanced knowledge of mathematics and astronomy. He found astronomical markers. One was a 60-ton rock that he believed had been moved to its location and then sculpted into what they wanted it to be. He found calendar stones. He found quite a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that this red-haired giant race that he talked about was actually rather advanced, which fits in with quite a lot of the writings and research of Zachariah Sitchin. Now, the question becomes, what happened to all these things that they found at the cave? And there's, of course, a number of stories. It used to be quite the thing to have a skeleton or a skull in your window if you had a store. One story said that the local Masonic Lodge took one of the skeletons to use in their ceremonies. The Nevada Historical Society in Reno is supposed to have some of the skeletons and one of the calendar stones. And the Historical Society in 1948 took a lot of the skeletons off Reed's hands, but they vanished until they were found in 1977. Then, of course, the the debunkers appeared. No matter what you find, no matter how much evidence you have, there'll be somebody. John, well, I'm sorry to see you go. There'll be somebody that's going to pop up and say, you don't know what you're talking about, even though they've never seen it themselves. And they'll make arguments, and they'll write books, and they'll do interviews. Even though they don't know what they're talking about. There are many people who don't want to be bothered with facts. We have a lot of them here in El Paso. Now, for those of you who remember the days of World War II, you might remember a magazine called Amazing Stories. Now, Amazing Stories was written by, or was published by Gray Barker, who was deeply involved in UFOs. Now, he took some stories from a man named Richard Shaver, and he published them as fiction under the title I Remember Lemuria. And the response from the public was phenomenal. Dozens of people said that they could confirm what Shaver said was true. And what it was a series of stories about a race of people who lived in underground caverns beneath the surface of Nevada. Lane says, I remember. You couldn't because I've got shirts older than you are. From the sound of your voice, you've got to be in your early to mid-30s. So you couldn't remember Lemuria. Now, Shaver's stories, and I said it was Gray Barker, it was Ray Palmer, who was a strange individual himself. Gray Barker wrote later. Now, magazine sales went through the roof as Mort. What do you mean, no? You could be saying I'm wrong because on my show I have to be right. That's why it's my show. Now, Shaver died in the 1970s. Moo. Well, moo is what a lot of people call it. Try a decade later. You're 23. I'd buy that. Now, you know, there have been stories all over the world about just turned 40. I knew I had shirts older than her. There's stories all over the world of as long as there ain't a moo moo. Well, if you got two cows, I guess you got a moo moo. You know, there have been in the Rig Veda, an ancient Hindu book, it talks about nuclear war and the fact that nuclear weapons were used in one of the battles that was described, and they described the aftermath of a nuclear attack very, very clearly. Well, on the Nevada side of Death Valley, U.S. Route 95 borders the eastern portion of Death Valley National Park. Now, this is about 140 or 150 miles north of Las Vegas. And there are vast deserted stretches of giant salt deposits, supposedly left over from when the valley was an inland sea. And it was somewhere around that location that an American explorer named Captain Ives William Walker stumbled upon the vitrified ruins of a mile-long ancient city. And among those ruins, there were liquefied rock surfaces that looked like they'd been attacked by, for all practical purposes, a flamethrower. Now, Walker's discovery wasn't that widely known. Was he Johnny Walker's cousin? No, but he was known to wear a red label from time to time. Rene Neubergen wrote a book called Secrets of the Lost Race in 1977. And in it, it's discussed that it may have been ancient atomic warfare that resulted in the destruction and vitrification of that ancient city. Now, for those that are not aware of the meaning of the word vitrification, if you've ever been to the Trinity site, you'll find that sand has been basically melted into glass. You'll find shards of glass in the desert. Some very, very ancient fortifications in Europe and the British Isles show vitrification, leading a lot of researchers to believe they may have been attacked with nuclear weapons, because that's the same type of aftermath you find after a nuclear explosion. If you've ever been at a Trinity site, that's what you'll find. Now, David Hatcher Childress, who's a guy I've gotten to know, he's written a number of books. He's found lost cities all over the world. And Charles Berlitz, who wrote a book called The World of Strange Phenomena. They fall back to the ancient East Indian narratives that I've talked about. Gilgamesh, in his search for immortality, and the Rig Veda, which talks about weapons such as erupting volcanoes wouldn't do what we're talking about. Now, the problem with scientists is they all look at their field of endeavor and, Chaska, you know David. Yeah, I just saw him at the book expo. He's promised to be on my show now for, since this one's been on. And he promised when I was doing my the one before. But, of course, he has never been available. Now, if you've ever been on State Highway 375, it's known as Extraterrestrial Highway in the state of Nevada. There have been a lot of things seen in the skies of Nevada. Not all of it makes sense. Now, the modern era of UFOs began June 24th, 1947. July 1947, the crash at Roswell. And the federal government seemed to go into overdrive. The NSA was created. The CIA was created. Now, 1947 was an unbelievable year for the strange objects in the Nevada skies. Flying saucers, flying washtubs, flying cardinal's hats are descriptions given by those who saw strange things in the sky. 4 days after Arnold's sighting, and he did his in Washington State, Air Force F-51 pilot Lieutenant Armstrong, 30 miles north of Lake Mead, claims he spotted a formation of five or six white disks flying about 6,000 feet. 3 weeks earlier, a red dish-shaped UFO had been sighted above Las Vegas. June 24, 1950, something totally unexplainable blazed across Nevada's night sky. That particular adventure began when two United Airlines pilots and their crews and passengers spied an object kind of dirigible shaped. Of course, they told the Civil Aviation Administration ground control at Silver Lake what they had seen. Two military planes sighted the same airship. And two of the Civil Aviation Administration radar operators at the checkpoint watched the object for over 10 minutes. Now, you have to ask yourself, why does our government continue to say that there are no UFOs when we, so many people have seen them? I stood at the black mailbox on the edge of Area 51 and watched things that couldn't be anything but UFOs flying in and out of Area 51. Now, you've heard about the crash at Roswell. There's a story about a crash at Aztec, New Mexico. But how about a secret UFO crash at Ely, Nevada? According to the story, a young woman was entertaining dinner guests one August evening in 1952 when she looked up and saw a flying saucer crash to Earth not too far from where she was at. And according to everything that can be found out, it didn't take long for those who were the first ones on the scene to realize there was something strange about this craft. It wasn't of this earth, and all the occupants were dead. Now, before much more could be found out by the locals, a government team came in, confiscated what was left of the vehicle, took everybody's cameras and any film they can get their hands on, and all the bodies. And managed to keep it out of the newspaper. The locals talk about it from time to time, if they're pretty sure you're not from the government. According to the folks from Ely, there were 16 alien bodies on board this craft that our government took for study. Not much else has been found about this crash. The Ely Times editor acknowledged that the 50th year anniversary by starting a campaign to try to get to the bottom of it. Turns out a night watchman at the local copper mine saw the crash and interviewed by government agents who told him to keep his mouth shut. And another old-timer in the bar told him that back in the early 50s, an Air Force jet crashed on Southridge overlooking Copper Flat. Now, certainly, the government would rather you know that a jet crashed rather than a UFO crashed. So the question was, are we dealing with a UFO crash or a jet? That might never be answered. But there's another event that's very difficult for anybody to explain away. It took place in April of 1962, and it was a Las Vegas UFO crash. A blinding light was seen flying over the city of Las Vegas at high speed. And it was what gave off that light was a vivid green in color. And it disappeared, according to folks in Reno who saw it. It disappeared over the mountains, traveling from west to east. And then as it was flying over the city of Reno, it took a sweeping turn to the south. Now, meteors don't take sweeping turns. The UFOs come to visit Vegas, after all, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Now, everybody's heard about the mystery lights of Marfa. Been down there and chased them. But these type of lights are actually reported from one end of the country to the other. We've lost Chaska again. Feeling abandoned. But if you ever go to McDermott, Nevada, which is at the Nevada-Oregon border, folks there have been seeing strange lights for over 100 years. Now, in Fate magazine, which is an interesting little magazine, it debuted in 1948, and the very first story that it had was about the phantom lights in Nevada. And that particular article talked about the fact that the lights actually encircled a group of people and frightened the horses and the dogs. And it didn't do the people any good. Now, McDermott tried to capitalize on the lights, of course, but didn't get far. Most people pretty much forgotten the McDermott lights, except the folks that live there. They're usually described as orange fireballs or twinkling, one more time, red or fluorescent yellow disc. Some say they look like car lights. Others say it looks like somebody swinging a lantern. And what's interesting is we always have people who explain away such things as lights by saying that they're car lights or train lights, even though Native Americans talked about them for hundreds of years before there were cars and trains. You know, Nevada's also an interesting place for all kinds of different creatures. Some not even in the casinos. You know, Nevada's got its share of lake monsters. Lake Lahontan once covered 8,000 square miles in northern Nevada and California. The size and the depth of this huge lake fluctuated over the 60,000 years that it was said to have existed. There was even, and a number of the fossils found absolutely can satisfy anybody who wants to find a lake monster. One of the creatures that I don't know what the problem is tonight. Must be my cough medicine. There was a cross between a plesiosaur and a pterodactyl, which got to be about 70 feet long. In fact, it's a Nevada's official state fossil. Now, I thought it was a couple of guys I saw at the casino in front of the slot machines, but apparently there's another fossil. Now, Nevada is considered the driest state in the Union. But interestingly enough, it has its own even the computers are acting strange tonight. We got a hell of a storm coming in here, so that may be the reason. There are three well-documented lake monsters in the state of Nevada. Now, one is called Cecil, and it's a mechanical serpent that is Hawthorne, Nevada's Goodwill ambassador and high school mascot. But it's not a public relations pipe dream. They're actually, according to the Indians that lived in the area, and when Lake Lahontan began to dry up, two of these sea serpents were forced apart. They were apparently mates. And the male made his way to what became known as Walker Lake, and the female burrowed into the ground. Now, the Walker Lake monster has Nevada's strongest record of sightings. When the settlers founded the town on the south end of Walker's Lake in 1881, they noticed there was a strange absence of fishing boats. Even the local Paiutes refused to travel in Can't Hear Me. I can hear me just fine. Wonder what the problem is. I know there's a problem when I can't hear me. Now, Walker Lake is the only lake where there were Native American villages where they never put boats in the water. In fact, the Indians said that there were one or more huge serpents that lived in the lake. Now, John Keel is probably one of the foremost collectors of the strange and the unusual since Charles Fort. And Keel did some research and said that early Indian settlers around the lake became a tad annoyed because the Walker Lake monster used to dine on members of the tribe. So they decided to trap and kill the creature, but the creature was a little smarter than they thought. According to the Indians, they actually struck a truce. He left them alone, they left him alone. Now, in the summer of 1876, the settlers launched a small steamer on the lake. On its maiden voyage, they ran into something. No one on board the ship would ever say what happened, but when they returned to their home port, they decommissioned the steamer. And made it clear that there did not need to be any boats on Lake Walker. Now, the Walker Lake Bulletin, which was a small paper, reported in August of 1883 that settlers near the lake continually heard horrible screechings. And when they investigated, they saw a pair of huge python-like creatures having a battle. And the fight went from the water up onto the shore before one of them finally collapsed. And the one that collapsed was measured at 79 feet, 7 1/4 inches. The winner went back into the water, but was seen quite often sunning himself on the surface. Been a number of sightings over the years, but it's kind of become kind of like Nessie. Nobody really wants to hurt him. A highway was built around the lake, and tourists started to come. And tourists and locals alike were reporting sightings of this huge creature. The most recent sighting came from the late 1950s. When a couple who were vacationing by the lake saw something cross it at very high speed before sinking. Well, so far, no one has been able to capture the creature. And there's another monster that's said to live in Lake Tahoe. Now, Lake Tahoe straddles the Nevada-California border, and it's been a big draw since John Fremont found it in the winter of 1844. This computer's really acting up. Maybe it'll stay correct now. When in doubt, just kick it. Now, the lake is 6,300 feet above sea level. And it's surrounded by mountains that tower 3,000 feet above the lake. It's the second deepest lake in the Northern Hemisphere with 71 miles of shoreline. Now, the Washoe Indians live in that area and have for many, many years. And they have long told stories of creatures and spirits that inhabit the Tahoe region. One of the stories they tell is about a creature they call Big Fish. It's now been known as Tahoe Tessie. Almost as soon as settlers began inhabiting the shores of Tahoe, and stories about this creature have been told. They've even been mentioned on the lifestyles of the rich and famous. It was the impetus for a best-selling children's book called Tahoe Tessie, The Original Lake Tahoe Monster, by a man named McCormick. And while he may be looked at as friendly today, kind of like Cecil the sea serpent, back in the 1800s, he was notoriously nasty. The Carson City Daily Index of May 11, 1883 talks about an encounter with a monstrosity that was anything but cute and cuddly. He rose up in front of the steamer, Governor Stanford, and snapped off the bow strip and carried it away. Well, the builder of the Stanford, Captain Latham, built a small schooner and went fishing. Now, back in the 30s, there were hunting parties organized to capture this creature. It'd be the ultimate fishing trophy. But it was smarter than the average bear. It outsmarted everybody. There have been stories about this creature right up to the 1990s. But it does make you wonder if we don't occupy this planet with other creatures that we have rarely seen. And then, of course, we have the Pyramid Lake monster. But one of the things that I find interesting, a local Indian around Lake Mojave caught a 60-pound prehistoric minnow in Lake Mojave in November of 1952. Now, the Indian and his family scaled, skewered, and kebabbed that sucker before the local fish and wildlife folks arrived to check it out. There was enough left for them to determine that that creature was of a species thought extinct for hundreds of thousands of years. The Laconia camp, which was caught off the coast of Africa, was supposedly extinct for over 62 million years. But nobody bothered to tell the fish. 10 years later, a sports fisherman caught a 62-pound specimen of that same creature. The fish and wildlife tried to take the one away from the sports fisherman. They wanted to study it, and he wanted to have it stuffed and put over his mantle. He won. Somewhere in a Las Vegas den sits this humongous minnow. Of course, we inhabit the planet with an unknown species. Just saw an article about fish discovered in the Great Barrier Reef, prehistoric six-gill sharks and such. Yeah, and every time I go downtown, I see things that shouldn't be living, but are. You know, one of the biggest... you know, one of the biggest bugaboos of Native American legends are giant birds. In this area, they're called the Thunderbird. But there are modern sightings even today of huge, I guess you can call them airborne monsters, some of which are big enough to pick humans up off the ground. There was a case of a 10-year-old Illinois boy who was picked up in 1977 by two creatures described as huge birds, wingspans about 10 feet. The kids had been playing in the backyard of the boy who was kidnapped, and these birds basically dive-bombed them. The kids took off running. One of the birds got close enough to this kid to grab him and had him off the ground when the mother ran out with the secret weapon of every mother everywhere, a broom, and proceeded to beat the bejesus out of the bird till he dropped the kid. Now, the Washoe Indians also had stories about giant birds. They called it the Ong, O-N-G. People of Walmart.com. Well, now, you know, there are many, many stories about the Walmart people. They're said to be unusual people. Now, the Ong was described by the local Indians as being bigger than the houses of the white man, with a body like an eagle's and the face of an Indian brave. Now, since it didn't bathe much, it stank. It was covered in feathers and impenetrable scales, a wingspan that eclipsed the tallest pine tree. And its feet were webbed. It didn't have claws. It would web you to death. Now, apparently amphibious, the Ong was said to nest deep at the bottom of the Lake of the Sky. But the Ong wasn't content, wasn't content to feast on fish. It would also eat the bodies of those that drowned. If you drown in the lake of the sky, quite often you're never seen again. And after developing a taste for human flesh, the Ong began to look for people to eat. They'd swoop down from behind and slap you silly with its webbed feet. And as soon as you fell in the water, it would pounce, take you high in the sky, and drop you. And the undercurrents would take you to the area where the nest was, where they would have a people burger. Well, the Washoe tell an interesting story. One season, as the Washoe got ready for the final hunt of the year, the chief promised his daughter to the tribe's most daring warrior. And the lucky man would be chosen by the elders of the tribe before they left the hunting area for their due to the onset of winter. Now the chief had a mind. The chief's daughter had a mind of her own. There was a brave she wanted to marry who was too young to have many adventures. The chief wanted somebody older and able to provide for his daughter. So in order to prove himself, this kid went out on to the cliffs overlooking the lake and sat considering the future and how to prove himself as a great warrior. Well, he glanced up and one of the Ong was circling overhead. So he jumped up and attracted the bird's attention, and of course it came flying in and grabbed him with the webbed feet. And as the Ong flew in the air getting ready to drop him into the water, untying a long cord that he had wrapped around his waist, he tied himself to the leg. Well, this kind of pissed off the Ong, who started doing aerobatics, trying to drop him, but he couldn't do it. So it decided to try to bite him, and that wasn't working because the kid was smart. He had some poisoned arrows that he kept sticking in the bird's mouth. And finally, the poison began to take effect, so the bird dived into the water, and the Ong flapped its wings and tried to figure out some way to get the kid off its leg. So as darkness fell, everybody assumed the Indian was dead, and the council fire took place so that they could choose the husband for the chief's daughter. Well, the chief's daughter stole a canoe and paddled out into the lake looking for Romeo. Nobody noticed it until it was too late. Well, finally they noticed the girl was missing. They started searching and they found an empty canoe floating near the shore. So the tribe assumed that for some reason she had gone out in the canoe and she was dead. But then somebody spotted the dead Ong floating in the lake. And then they saw this really bizarre looking boat approaching. It was one of the wings with the tip of the other wing fashioned into a sail. And on it were the chief's daughter and the young brave that she wanted to marry. So the name of the brave was Tahoe, so the Washoe changed the name of the Lake of the Sky to Lake Tahoe. And that's supposedly how it's got its name. And the Ong nest is still at the bottom of the lake. And those who drown are still not found. Now, we do know that at one point in time there existed a bird with a 16-foot wingspan. It was a prehistoric condor. And it may be possible the story of the Ong is actually a story of the condor and its battles with the Indians. Now, in April 2005, a man was interviewed by George Noory, who said while flying a Cessna over northwest Nevada, he saw a bird that had an estimated wingspan of 15 to 20 feet. That's one hell of a bird, folks. Now, there are quite a number of stories of strange creatures that you'll hear in Nevada and parts of California, even here in Texas. And some of the stories that we've heard and read may well be accounts of real beasts. In the late 1800s, the newspapers of northern Nevada entertained the locals with reports of a unique creature by the name of the Wahoo. The Reno Weekly Gazette had the first description. A man named Smith had been hunting in the vicinity of Halleck and Deeth, which are ghost towns near Elko. And the locals told him about the Wahoo, and it was named the Wahoo because of the sound that it makes. Wahoo! Now, he didn't see it himself, but he said his brother did. In fact, his brother had obtained a tanned hide of the creature. The legs were short with large paws and long claws, and the body was long and slender. Now, the creature said to be very vicious, and two hunters had come upon this creature. One was carrying a pitchfork, and the creature attacked, and he ran it through. I'm currently researching Wisconsin. I'm going to Oshkosh for the annual fly-in. Well, let me say this about that without fear of contradiction. Wisconsin has strange stories. You know, it's interesting that the stories about the Wahoo. There's been a number of dog-like creatures reported. The hacker attack last Thursday during TED time. My computer crashed then, too. Certainly, how are you, Carla? I've had a couple of death threats from the hackers, and I invited them to come visit me because Texas has something called the Castle Doctrine. And so far, they haven't showed up. So the question is, was the Wahoo real? Many say it was. There are Native American tribes that have a legend of dog-like beasts called the Shunkowark and the Carrying-Off Dogs. There's a book called Trails to Nature's Mysteries that talks about the killing of a wolf-like beast described as being nearly black and having high shoulders and a back that sloped downward like a hyena. I used to work with somebody who matched that description. And then, of course, we have Bigfoot, which has been seen in quite a number of places in Nevada. In fact, in 1999, near Battle Mountain, they're supposed to have captured one. And no discussion of, well, before I start into this next topic, let me remind you about the garden. I was there today for lunch, and they have got everything from sushi to burgers. The food is great. It's down in the warehouse district here in El Paso. In fact, I've given away a couple of gift coupons for folks that want to go down there. Every report I get is glowing. They just opened a pub called the Commonwealth. They also have the Jeske's Fire Grill on Lee Trevino. And the most people think the young lady that runs the fire grill is our daughter. No relation, but certainly we've known her a long time. Now, if you into Italian food, go to Marcello's. If you want American cuisine, a little Japanese, as well with sushi, you might try the Garden. If you want a burger that's out of this world, try Jeske's Fire Grill on Lee Trevino. Any of my sponsors that you go to, if you mention you heard about them on the show, I'll greatly appreciate it. And, of course, as we add more sponsors, we'll be adding more. I'm looking for some national giveaways, you know, coupons I can give you on the national chains. I think you will find that after our the unveiling of the new show, in which will take place September or October, you'll find something for everybody. Now, you can't talk about Las Vegas without talking about the one and only Bugsy Siegel. When he arrived, it was a small desert town. Had a couple of mom-and-pop casinos. But it never had a palm tree until Bugsy Siegel arrived. He ordered them from California to be sent in. Now, his name wasn't really Bugsy. It was Benjamin. But he was called Bugsy because a lot of folks thought he was nutso. He started his criminal career at age of 9, setting vegetable carts on fire in kind of a protection racket. Now, in the 30s and 40s, he went to Las Vegas because that was the most profitable, glamorous place in the country. And he went to Los Angeles in the 1930s and started making millions of dollars for himself and for the syndicate. He'd long been involved with organized crime. Meyer Lansky wasn't, and he were came from the same area. They were almost blood brothers. Interestingly enough, it was Lansky that ordered the hit. Now, Bugsy Siegel also wanted to be an actor, and he was certainly handsome enough. But he didn't have any talent. One of the young ladies attracted by his persona, oh, we lost Cat Star. Oh, she's about, okay. There was an actress by the name of Virginia Hill who he took up with. She was an actress in name only. Most of her money came by threatening to expose the secrets of many of the Hollywood stars that had not yet come out of the closet. She was also on the payroll of the mob, assigned to keep an eye on Bugsy Siegel. And she's the one that let the mob know he was skimming money from the till. Well, according to the story, during one of his drives back to the East Coast, he would pass through Nevada, and on this one particular night, your plug got pulled. People have tried to do that to me too, but so far they haven't been successful. He stopped in Las Vegas to go to the bathroom. And standing in that gravelly parking lot, having just relieved himself, he had this vision of what Las Vegas could be. The bathroom stop of the world. There were a couple of, as I said earlier, small ma-and-pa casinos. He wandered in and watched people shoveling the money into the slots and at the card tables. And he decided if he could provide the right combination of glamour and gambling, he could make untold millions. He just needed somebody to back him. Now, Siegel was an excellent gangster, but he wasn't that bright a businessman, and he loved to spend money, especially on horses, dining, and women. Not necessarily in that order. He set out to build a $1 million hotel casino, and it wound up costing $5 million. He called it the Flamingo, which he actually named after Hill because he used to call her the Flamingo because of her impossibly long legs. Opened for business in December of 1946. It didn't have the cowboy look of the other establishments in town. In fact, it was a swank class operation. No bolo ties, no boots, no plaid shirts. Top Hollywood entertainers were brought in to entertain the guests. And the staff wore formal dress. Well, opening night didn't go as planned. Freak thunderstorms kept the planes on the ground so the entertainers couldn't get there. The rooms weren't ready to be occupied. The air conditioning didn't work. Other than that, everything was fine, though. The Siegel's backers were not happy campers, which was not good for Siegel. In Las Vegas, Siegel was surrounded by bodyguards loyal to him. In fact, from his office, there was a ladder that in a closet that went down to a tunnel that ran into a garage, and there was a car waiting for him with a driver, and it was there 24/7. His office was also bulletproof. Now, he had gone to visit Virginia Hill in Beverly Hills. She was living in the house belonging to one of her marks, I guess you could say. Of course, she was out of the country. Bugsy and a friend of his were there at the Virginia Hills house. Siegel was sitting and reading the paper, and he switched on a reading lamp. A sniper shot him right through his eye. And so ended Bugsy Siegel. You know, it's interesting to note how many people have headlined at in Vegas. You know, when Elvis first went, you know, he had number one records, been on Ed Sullivan Show. He was hired at a very large salary to entertain in Vegas, and he bombed. But the next time he came, his teenage audience were now middle-aged, and he packed them in. But the most successful entertainer to hit Vegas was Mr. Showmanship himself, Liberace. Now, he was born and raised in Milwaukee, but Las Vegas considered him a native son. The Tivoli Gardens restaurant on Tropicana, owned by Liberace, was a favorite with the locals. And the Liberace Museum is in the same strip mall as the Tivoli Gardens. And even decades after Liberace's death, the museum is still a top spot for tourists. Now, surprisingly enough, Liberace lived in a middle-class neighborhood. And his house on Shirley Street, from the outside, is not very remarkable. But once you step into it, that's a different matter completely. So actually, two houses have been combined into one for 20,000 square feet of unbelievable luxury. He admired the Sistine Chapel on a visit to Vatican City, so he hired a descendant of Michelangelo's to paint a copy on the ceiling of his master bedroom. That one-of-a-kind painting is valued at over $1 million on the ceiling of his bedroom. The sunken marble bathtub in his master bath cost $65,000. The chandelier hanging in the master bedroom, $25,000. He died in 1987, and he's haunted the Tivoli Gardens ever since. Number of people. Well, I was in Vegas. I had the opportunity to go. A number of people reported seeing what they thought was a Liberace impersonator standing by the piano, because his piano sits in the garden. And when the diner asked the manager, could the Liberace impersonator play her favorite song? He said, "What impersonator? There's nobody here." And she said, "I just saw him a minute ago." Now, if you ever go to Vegas, when you have a moment away from the gambling tables, you need to go see Medusa Sedusa. Now, the young lady in question admits that's not her legal name, but it's the only name she gives, and it's the name she's gone by for quite a number of years. Brazilian-born, she's one of Las Vegas' most colorful characters. She has a website, MedusaSedusa.com. And while wild animal acts are not unique in Vegas, hers is. her act is basically indescribable. When she does her show, she's has a sword and she's wearing what resembles a Princess Leia slave girl outfit. And she prances about barefoot. And she does a dance with her 9-foot albino python. And when she dances with that snake, everybody watches. She believes that Clara Bow, the famous actress, is her personal guardian and looks out for her. You know, there's been quite a lot of strange things take place in Vegas. When I was there, I was asked if I wanted to be part of a seance. And it had been years since I'd been to a seance, so I said, certainly. And it took place in Liberace's dressing room in the strip mall that holds the Liberace Museum and the Tivoli Gardens. And there were some, 20 of us there. 7 were asked to sit at this large table, and I was one of the 7. And the medium comes in, who is, she wasn't medium, she was buxom, I guess is the best word. And she began to do her, your seance thing. She was sitting with her back to the wall at the head of the table. Now, clearly, a lot of what took place for entertainment value. That doesn't mean that that I was buying the whole show. At one point, the lights went out, and she began to talk about a creature that had entered the room. And 2 red glowing eyes appeared. There was a scream, a flash. Lights came on, and she was gone. Now, I was a bit distracted in following what was going on because the young lady sitting to my right had the grip of a pro linebacker, and when she grabbed my arm when the red eyes appeared, cut the circulation off to my hand. But as much examination as I was able to do, unless the wall rotated, I couldn't figure out what happened to the medium, which of course was the object of the show. Now, those of you who are signed into the chat room, if you'd be so kind to send a friend request, I'd greatly appreciate it. I'm trying to build up the number of friend requests my show has received. And it's always fun to see who has been there. Now, Vegas is nothing if not adventurous. Some of the wedding packages that are available would absolutely make anybody happy. You, no matter what your belief is, you can find You like Star Trek? They'll put you on the bridge of the Enterprise for your wedding. Now, October 31st, 1926, is a date that you may be familiar with. It's the day Harry Houdini died. But he told his wife, her name was Bess, or Elizabeth, that if there were a gateway to the world of the living, he'd find it and contact her. And they had previously worked out a secret code known only to them. Now, for 10 years after his death, she held a seance every Halloween night in the hopes that he would contact her. In 1936, after having had so many charlatans falsely claimed to have heard the secret message, she announced that her last hope was gone. She didn't believe Houdini could come back and she was through doing seances. But the desire to contact Harry Houdini has never gone away. There are people who do a seance every Halloween. Las Vegas has an individual named Dixie Dooley. I've read a couple of articles about him. Didn't get a chance to track him down while I was there. And he's not just a Houdini enthusiast. He's also a magician who has modeled his act after Houdini's. And for over 20 years, he has held the Houdini seance in Las Vegas. It's open to the public. The last time it was held, 5,000 people showed up. Now, according to Dooley, while Houdini never claimed spirits didn't exist, I have not been. He never saw any evidence they did. Dooley, on the other hand, says he's actually had contact with the other side. He held a seance for Elvis at the Greek Isles Hotel. And he said, you know, it hardly ever rains in Vegas. And this was another bright, sunny day, and they had a very unusual crowd. Fans of the occult, fans of Elvis, and just folks that wanted something to do. He said the very moment he called out to the spirits of Elvis, there was a crack of thunder, and it began to rain. Well, I see Ted is on the line, so if you'll be so kind as to bring him on, I would appreciate it.
Ken, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you. How are you doing?
Oh, Ken, what my tush goes through for our audience.
Okie dokie?
Oh, yeah. Ken, I just sat through a 2.5-hour movie.
And?
And I know why they made it.
Money.
Of course. But it does fit into our subject matter, which is the paranormal.
Okay.
Now, this is a PG-13 rated movie, so you can bring the kids. There is no nudity, gratuitous sex. There's a lot of violence, but it's fairly stylized. And I think the kids will probably crack up. There are also a few unintentional jokes, but it's like, oh my God. And it has the most cheater ending I have seen in a long, long time. $200 million it cost to make Inception, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. $200 million. Okay. Now, it is basically an excuse for a great many special effects.
Okay.
Here's the premise. The Army. Notice how we keep coming back to the Army?
Oh, yes.
Developed a method of sharing dreams, which involves extracting information from other people.
Yes.
By getting into their dreams and manipulating the dream. Okay?
Yes.
All right. So far, simple enough. Our star, Leonardo DiCaprio, it turns out, and we have to wait about an hour into the picture before we find out why he's on the run, but he's on the run from the United States. If he goes to the United States, he'll be arrested. Turns out he will be arrested for the murder of his wife, and it was his wife who committed suicide and set him up. Now, his
That's a determined issue to set somebody up, to commit suicide to do it.
Yeah, so now his wife, Mal, is played by Marion Cotillard, whom I'm sure you remember as Edith Piaf.
Okay.
In Piaf, La Vie en Rose.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm sure you also remember her from Public Enemies, in which she was pretty good. I believe she was opposite Leo DiCaprio in that one. No, it was Johnny Depp, excuse me. I was close.
Yeah.
She appeared in Nine. She played Luisa Contini, the wife of the director whose story is being told.
Yes.
The musical, she had to sing. And she actually handled herself rather well. Although, if you go back and look at Otto e Mezzo, the director's wife was played by probably one of the greatest French actresses of all time.
Sophia Loren?
No, she played his mother, and she's Italian. The director's wife was played by, I'm going just a little bit blank, so I'm going to look it up. You know what? I'm looking up the wrong movie. I just looked up Nine and not Otto e Mezzo. But it was played by the girl from A Man and a Woman and the sequel. And I know how I'll look it up. I'll just punch up a man and a woman. Okay, and we're going to get her name in a New York Minute. And she was the wife in 1966, directed by Claude Lelouch, and Anouk Aimée.
Mm.
Who is still extraordinarily beautiful, by the way, and is now all of 78 years old. It's amazing. So she was about 30 when she played the wife in Otto e Mezzo.
Mm-hmm.
She was 34 when she played the widowed script girl in A Man and a Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was 54, and she was actually playing her real age, I think, about by that time, when she did the sequel, A Man and a Woman 20 Years Later, which, by the way, was a fabulous adventure movie.
Okay.
Now, we just have to get away from that for a minute, because that got us on to this. This is a digression from Marion Cotillard. And I got to get back to this picture, because it is... You know, if it worked for the ending, I'd give it 3 stars. It takes a half an hour, fully 2 reels, to get through the basic exposition as to what this thing is all about. Now that Leonardo DiCaprio is on the run, he has a team that he works with, kind of like the A-Team, but not as funny. And they go around doing jobs, extracting information from rich people and wealthy industrialists and God only knows who else, around the world for lots of money. Unfortunately, Leonardo DiCaprio, it turns out, got a little bit too deep into his sleep, and his late wife keeps appearing as a projection in his dreams and occasionally foiling the plots. Now, let's think about this from the paranormal aspect, shall we?
All right.
Is there anyone who is an expert on dreams and getting into them? I mean, do we have any books out there about people getting, you know, poking around in other people's dreams?
No, but there was a movie.
Yeah?
This just sounds like a remake of that one.
Tell me.
I can't remember the title of it. Eddie Albert played the president who was having nightmares. And they
Dreamscape.
That's it.
All right, let's look it up. Dreamscape. Edward Albert, who died about a year ago, right?
Guess that means he won't be on my show.
I don't know. You never know who's going to be on your show.
That's true.
Okay, Dreamscape 1984. And Dennis Quaid, Max von Sydow, Christopher Plummer, Eddie Albert. Yeah, a government-funded project looks into using psychics to enter people's dreams with some mechanical help. When a subject dies in his sleep from a heart attack, Alex Gardner becomes suspicious that another of the psychics is killing people in the dream somehow, and that is causing them to die in real life. He must find a way to stop the abuse of power to enter dreams. Got it. Yeah, not exactly. But it's interesting that you came up with that connection. So, excuse me?
That's my job, to come up with strange connections.
Well, you know, you're doing a great job tonight.
I try.
First of all, we have Leo DiCaprio. Have you noticed that over the years, Leo DiCaprio has developed an amazing scowl?
Well, after freezing his ass off on the Titanic, I don't blame him.
You know, I think he even had that scowl then. But the scowl, I mean, it's those two vertical lines above the nose, between the eyebrows, makes a fellow always look angry.
Yeah.
Well, Sir Michael Caine is in this picture, and I have to give him credit for not having that, because he's certainly old enough.
Yeah.
And DiCaprio's maybe, what, about 40-ish? I got to just look him up to see, just for argument's sake. No, he's 35. My God. Well, he looks like a much older man. Any case, so we have Leo DiCaprio as the head dreamer, if you will. And what they do is they go through levels. They have dreams within dreams.
Yeah.
Okay? And apparently if you get to the third level, which is a dream within a dream within a dream, you're on pretty dangerous ground. You might not make it back. Well, any case, DiCaprio is hired by a guy named Sato, who's played by Ken Watanabe, whom I'm sure you've seen in a great many action films.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a very interesting actor, but his Japanese accent is rather thick. And this is a problem in that it's often difficult to understand his lines. He's very convincing, though. I got to give the guy credit. I always liked Ken Watanabe. But I think what you need for American audiences either is subtitles or a dialogue coach.
Makes sense.
Ellen Page. One of the funniest girls in movies. Absolutely charming in those Cisco Systems commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Is so miscast in this part. She plays an architect, or an architecture student, I should say. By the way, DiCaprio in the picture is an architect, and so is his father-in-law, played by Sir Michael Caine. Okay? In fact, his father-in-law is a professor of architecture at the Sorbonne. All of them are into this dream manipulation thing.
Yep.
It turns out, somehow or other, that Ken Watanabe, who was the target of DiCaprio in the opening reel of the movie...
Yeah.
Actually set him and his team up. He wants to hire them. After about half an hour, Ken, it takes half an hour to get to the point where we find out what this picture is all about. Watanabe runs an energy company in Japan. He is up against a company headquartered in Sydney, Australia, that is about to monopolize the world's energy supply. And his problem is, we can't compete. You must therefore plant an idea in the head of the son of the guy who owns the company and built it, a fellow who is soon to die. Plant the idea in the son's head that he has to break up the company. And you have to do it in his dreams. Well. Okay. The reason we have architects, apparently, is so they can construct the settings of the dreams. All right?
Mm-hmm.
There's also a little issue, if you will, with a thing called projections. When you go into somebody's dream, apparently they have people who are projections. They can be people on the street. They can be all kinds of things. They can be... For example, in this case, projections are a personal security army hired by the young rich guy to protect himself, but it's all in his subconscious.
Makes sense.
Okay, all right. So now we go on to the plot, which involves... And this is the only funny line in the picture. There are other lines that are funny, but not intentionally. They have to get the guy alone for about 12 hours. Now, as you know, the commercial airline flight from Sydney to LAX is about 12 hours long. Well, the airplane will have to be a 747. Wouldn't he fly by private jet? Well, no, not if his plane is having unexpected maintenance problems. Well, it'd have to be a 747 because the cockpit and first class are upstairs. So yeah. You wouldn't have people walking through first class. Yes, and you'd have to pay off the flight attendant, too. Matter of fact, you'd probably have to buy out the entire first class cabin. And Sato says, oh, I bought the airline. It just seemed easier. I like that one.
Hey, when you got to do something, do it right.
Right. Now, the other thing that I thought was interesting was that the house in which Leonardo DiCaprio had lived with his wife and kids,
yes,
was the Frank Lloyd Wright house from early in his career, I'd say pre-World War I. I thought that was interesting. The other thing I thought that was interesting was one of the signals that was used to wake people up from the dreams or let them know that the kick was about to come.
Yes.
The kick being something that kicks you up from one phase of the dream to the phase above it.
Yeah.
Okay? And there are issues about going deeper and whatnot, but was the Edith Piaf song, Je ne regrette rien. And who sang that song in the movie about Piaf but Marion Cotillard?
Okay.
I thought it was kind of interesting. I also thought it was interesting that Cillian Murphy, the Irish actor,
uh-huh,
who was in that Batman movie, The Dark Knight,
mm-hmm,
directed, by the way, by Christopher Nolan. And I'm thinking, you know, put the money aside for a minute. If I were Christopher Nolan, I'd find another line of work. Maybe writing bogus subprime mortgages. I think that would work for him. But, in any case, this is a guy who knows how to drag out a scene and drag it out and drag it out and drag it out until the celluloid is stretched so thin we think that the print is about to break.
Hmm.
Well, make a long story short. Ellen Page is an architecture student recruited by Leonardo DiCaprio, courtesy of his father-in-law, Michael Caine. Cillian Murphy is the mark. Ken Watanabe is the client. And we have a few other folks involved in this, including Lucas Haas, who has a rather amusing part as a guy named Nash. The rather interesting Dilip Rao as Yusuf, who is a chemist, who is also into this whole dream thing, but he's doing it in what is the capital of Uganda?
Kampala?
Kampala. Yeah, maybe it's Kampala. It's one of those places in Africa. But that's where he's doing it. And he's got all these guys in his basement hooked up to dream machines, all wired to each other, all on a major sedative, because they're so addicted to this form of dreaming that it's the only way they can sleep.
Hmm.
Okay, fine. Well, it's nice to see Tom Berenger working again. He plays the number two guy to the Maurice Fisher character, the dying man, which was played by Pete Postlewhite.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually does a fairly good job. I think he would be good for, at his age now, for a remake of Broderick Crawford's Highway Patrol. But as I'm looking at this thing, here's what we have. We have three levels of dream. We have the first level.
Yes.
In which they kidnap young Fisher.
Yes.
The heir to the energy company.
Yes.
We have the second level in which they attempt to plant the idea into young Fisher's head that his father would have wanted him to break up the company.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the third level in which I am not quite sure what in heaven's name happens, except that DiCaprio is reunited with his wife, played by Marion Cotillard, who somehow or other is trying to get him to kill himself and stay in the dream world with her.
Hmm.
In fact, what he had done, and this does not come out till the end of the picture, or almost the end, it comes out in the final reel. What he had done was he had planted the idea in her head that she had to kill herself to get out of this dream world because it was becoming her reality. The two of them were doing a little too much fooling around dreaming. And in the dream world, time goes by a lot faster. The mind works a lot faster than in the real world. Are you following me?
I think so.
Okay, you are not totally confused. Because I'm at the point where I need a scorecard.
Well, basically, he committed murder by dreaming.
So to speak, except for one thing. He had her die in the dream so that she could live a normal life. Unfortunately, the idea that he planted in her head became her reality. And she killed herself on their wedding anniversary by jumping out of a hotel suite window and challenging her husband to go with her. And how she was going to make sure he would was by giving a letter to her lawyer, notarized, saying that she was terribly afraid of his violence toward her, basically framing him for the murder, which, in fact, was a suicide.
Hmm.
He then had to leave the country. And being a spook, it wasn't too hard for him to get out. How one goes from being an architect to being a spook is an iffy proposition, except that we know that Ellen Page as Ariadne does it.
Well, it's really not that hard.
Really? Talk to me. Tell me.
You just have to know the right people.
Indeed.
Yep.
Well, isn't that the same thing for all of us? I mean, how could your film critic become a spook?
Well, what you could do is call George and tell him that you have come up with a way to serve your country and you want his help.
Which George?
W. He's making a comeback.
W is making a comeback?
Yeah. There are billboards up in the Northeast, and it says, "You miss me yet?"
You know, this is the funny thing, because some people were asking me about President Obama the other day. They wanted my opinion. And I said to them, well, I think he's basically George Bush without the addiction problems. Because I'm looking at what he's doing, and he's doing everything George Bush did.
That's true.
I mean, you might as well vote Bush for a third term. The only thing is, I'll give Obama credit. He's a much better speech maker.
Yes, but he has the teleprompter with him all the time.
Has he?
Yeah.
I suppose he has that so he doesn't fall into Joe Biden's trap.
Well, that's true. And it's come out now that Mort Zuckerman wrote one of Obama's best speeches.
Mort Zuckerman?
Yeah.
Who owns the Daily News and U.S. News?
That's right.
Rich, which speech did he write?
He didn't say. He just admitted he'd written one of them.
Ah, how interesting. Well, you know, there's a man who lives not too far from me in New York who wrote most of the really memorable speeches given by JFK. His name is Theodore Sorensen.
Huh.
And he was, after leaving the White House many years, a lawyer in private practice in New York. Very, very nice man, by the way. He must be close to 80 by now. But I had met him a couple of times as a college kid and liked him immensely. But he was the guy who wrote the inauguration speech. My fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Yes.
The torch of freedom has been passed to a new generation of Americans.
Yes.
Okay. And it goes on. I mean, some of the most inspiring stuff that JFK said was written by Ted Sorensen. However, we digress from the movie. We take the guy down two levels. Okay? A dream within a dream. Using very, very powerful sedatives.
Yeah.
But sedatives which are set not to disrupt the functioning of the inner ear, which handles balance. As I see it, if I were on that sedative, it wouldn't make much difference because I don't balance that great to begin with. You ought to see me on the ski slopes. But then they have the musical cue to pull people out of this, and the problem, which is if you go into the dream state for too long, or if you die in the dream and don't wake up, eventually you go, if you're in the third level, you go into limbo, and you spend the rest of eternity with your mind turning to mush. I'm not exactly sure how that works. Maybe Harry Houdini could tell us.
Kind of like if you listen to too many political speeches.
You know, I was glancing the other day at the Fox News channel.
Yes.
And Glenn Beck was on. Well, actually, two things happened. I glanced at the Fox News channel a few days ago, and Glenn Beck was on. And he was talking about Senator Joe McCarthy.
Yes.
And he was defending Senator McCarthy. Now, it's a very interesting thing that he was defending Senator McCarthy, and this was the crux of his defense. There actually were communists in the U.S. State Department in the late 1940s.
That's true.
Yes, it is true. They were called in those days progressives. There was only one guy in the State Department, to my knowledge, who ever got convicted of spying for the Soviet Union. Actually, he wasn't even convicted of spying for the Soviet Union. He was convicted of perjury because Nixon, as a congressman on the Un-American Activities Committee, caught him in a perjury trap, and that was Alger Hiss. The Pumpkin Papers?
Yes.
Whitaker Chambers ratted him out?
Yes.
And Hiss denied it. There was sufficient evidence to prove that Hiss had done it. Years later, it came out, and I think it was before Nixon's death, I'm not sure. But Alger Hiss at the time was still alive. It came out that Hiss really did give secrets to the Russians.
Yes.
Okay? But so far as we know, he was the only one, and apparently what the Rosenbergs gave the Russians was far more dangerous. Stalin had spies everywhere, including Los Alamos.
That's true.
Now, a few pinkos in the State Department didn't amount to a hill of beans. Truman got rid of them. But what we got was this thing called the blacklist.
Yes.
And, you know, there were people whose, especially in the entertainment business, whose careers were ruined by other people who had far less talent, but were a lot meaner. And what they did was they got somebody's name into this magazine called Red Channels.
Mm-hmm.
And if your name got listed in Red Channels, and maybe, you know, they listed your name because somebody had a name similar to yours, and you were seen marching in a May Day parade or attending a May Day parade, you got listed as a communist sympathizer. But it wasn't really you, it was somebody with the same name or a similar name, and somebody just spelled it wrong. So this was used to end the careers of a lot of people, including the first Alice on the Honeymooners, a lady whose picture is still up at Sardi's. Her name is Pert Kelton. She played Alice before Audrey Meadows. When the show went from Dumont to the CBS television network, CBS would not allow her to be cast because she was listed in Red Channels. Now, I am sure that Pert Kelton was about as much a danger to the Republic as I am.
Well, you never can tell.
Hey, you know, I could be a bigger danger to the Republic. God only knows. I go on the radio and talk about President Obama. I actually like the guy, even though he ran against me.
Well, I'd like to hear him do a speech without a teleprompter.
I'd like to hear me do a speech without a teleprompter. I got news for you. Tonight I am not reading a thing. The only stuff I'm looking up is what's on IMDb Pro, so that I can talk about the backgrounds of different people. But You know, here's the problem with this picture. We got so many special effects which are not really compelling, and they're dragged out. You know how tabloid television drags out a story? They start in the middle, and then they work backwards to the beginning, and finally, after the last commercial, you finally figure out what the story's about?
Yes.
That's how this picture works. Now, I'm not going to give away the ending, but it is the cheapest blackout I have ever seen.
Well, they're getting ready for the sequel.
That's what I was thinking walking out of the theater, but, you know, at $200 million for the first one, I'm like, brother, $200 million for the first... The other thing I would like to know is how, after being out of contact with his son-in-law for a number of days, if not weeks, Michael Caine somehow ends up from his classroom at the Sorbonne and to Los Angeles International Airport to meet Leo DiCaprio and knows what plane he's going to be on.
Remote viewing.
You think?
The only thing that makes sense.
Brother. You know what I'd like to have? I'd like to have remote viewing of tomorrow's stock prices.
That just make you too depressed.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd know what to buy.
Or sell.
I'd like to have remote viewing of who's going to win the horse race, the eighth race at Aqueduct on Saturday.
Well, the next time I'm remote viewing, I'll look.
You got to let me know a couple of days in advance so I can go to OTB.
Okay.
Best tip I got on a horse recently was from a cab driver in New York. And I went and I was stupid. He was saying this horse is going to finish in the money. Well, I went and I put $20 to win on the horse. Damn it, the horse showed.
Well, at least he found the finish line.
Yeah, well, you know, his horse still came in the money. So, yeah, but any case.
The best tip I ever got was at a Panamanian racetrack. The kid was 9 years old. He gave me the winners in the first four races. Who listens to a 9-year old?
Well, the soap lady's 9 years old.
He called them all right.
Yeah.
Turns out he had grown up at the track.
So did my first wife. But she couldn't pick a winner to save her life. She was the equestrian champion of the United States in 1971. But at the racetrack, she was a disaster. I went to the races with her. Oh, my God. All I did was lose. On her picks.
Well, you know, of course, that my first mother-in-law could probably have picked every race had we been on speaking terms because she looked like so many of the horses.
Really? So she could go to the paddock and, you know, pretend to be Mr. Ed?
Hey.
And chat up the other horses? Which Mr. Ed did do in one episode.
That's quite correct.
All right, Ken. We're getting far off the subject of movies. I'm going to wrap up this picture because, you know, it's not really worth any more discussion. I'm going to have to write about it because it's going to get a lot of interest. It's got a really excellent cast. I think I totally adore Ellen Page. I think she is totally miscast in this movie. Sir Michael Caine has a part that is way too small for his talent. And he is, without question, still at the top of his game. Ken Watanabe, I already told you what I thought. I'll repeat it. Either subtitles or a dialogue coach, because the Japanese accent makes it difficult to understand some of the plot points that originate in the dialogue. Fortunately, the director, Chris Nolan, who also wrote the screenplay, repeats his plot clues so many times and stretches them out so many times that it's not that big a problem. The problem for me is this. Number one, the ending is a cheat. Number two, it's 2.5 hours long. Number three, it needs a lot more comic relief. Number four, it has Leonardo DiCaprio. And number five, Chris Nolan directed it and wrote the screenplay. We all know what I thought of The Dark Knight, which I believe I did discuss on this program.
Yes, it certainly was not one of your favorite movies.
I thought it blanked. Okay? So, enough of that. Oh, boy, I really need to see a funny chick flick. I need to see something with Sandra Bullock.
Well, come to Texas.
Yeah, I mean a movie.
Oh, well.
I'd love to meet Sandra Bullock, except once I have met Sandra Bullock, I will probably like her so much that I won't be able to keep my personal feelings out of the reviews.
Well, certainly that could be a possibility.
Yes, it can, Ken. And I'm thinking that, well, it's the same problem I have with George Clooney. He's so nice. And I've met him on a number of occasions. There is a temptation to want to give Clooney a pass. Fortunately, if I succumb to the temptation, I'm only succumbing to reality because he's that good an actor. I can't say the same thing about Brad Pitt, but I've never met Brad Pitt. I can't say the same thing about Tom Cruise, and I have met Tom Cruise.
Yes, but Tom Cruise is odd.
Yeah, so's Brad Pitt a little bit. I mean, you know, Angelina Jolie, I don't know what her whole thing is. I know she does all this work for the United Nations, which I think is a very good thing, but I don't understand why she made herself become a walking X-ray. I mean, she got so thin that she looks unhealthy. Now, she had to look unhealthy for her part in Girl Interrupted, which was her breakthrough movie.
Yeah.
With Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
But she didn't look excessively skinny. She just looked like your average drug addict, which was what she was supposed to be, a psychotic drug addict.
Makes sense.
By the way, I did read the book.
Yes.
Apparently, she went on to lead a rather normal life after her institutionalizations. The character, that is.
Yeah, I was going to say, Angelina Jolie has not led a normal life.
Hardly. No, I don't understand her and Brad Pitt at all. And I cannot understand why Jennifer Aniston cannot keep a boyfriend.
Well, sometimes there are mysteries in life.
And that is a mystery that I am not going to solve.
Well, you could ask her.
I don't think so. I'm more concerned with her pictures than her you know, what they say about her in People magazine.
Well, if I can get her on the show, call in and ask.
If you can get her on the show, I'll interview her.
That sounds good. I'm easy.
All right. I don't do, I avoid celebrity interviews like the plague. But once in a great while, when the stars give press conferences after the screenings,
yeah,
I'll go and I'll ask a couple of questions because they might not be entirely apparent from the film or the credits or the press material, for that matter. And generally, by asking one of the actors, I can get an answer and will solve a lot of problems. For example, there was an Australian movie I wrote about, about a year ago. It was the Tribeca Film Festival.
Yeah.
And it was set in Connecticut. And everybody in the picture sounded like they were from Connecticut. There was only one American actor in the picture. It was Gina Davis. The other thing that was interesting about it was all the American cars they had from the late 60s and early 70s. And in Australia, up until a few years ago, and this I did not know, I knew that up until a few years ago, American cars had to be converted to right-hand drive for Australia.
Yes.
It was illegal to drive a car in Australia with the steering wheel on the left. So there were businesses that actually would make these conversions. And last I was in Sydney, I saw a few of them. So I do know a little bit about that flight, by the way, in the movie from LAX to, from Sydney to LAX. It's long. Oh, is it long? And let me tell you something. If you can avoid Qantas, avoid it. The only airline where the cabin crew treats you as if you're a private and they're the drill sergeants.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. And that I can live without. By the way, you know that R. Lee Emery guy on the military channel? The one who does mail call?
Mm-hmm.
He apparently used to be a drill sergeant.
Oh, that wasn't
Excuse me?
That wasn't hard to figure out.
Yeah, well, he's got the drill sergeant shout and all that. And, you know, he's doing commercials now.
Yeah, I saw him do one the other night for, I forget what it was. It had something to do with, he was a shrink. And
yeah, exactly. I think it was for Geico Insurance.
Well, the voice of the gecko got fired, so they had to do something.
The voice of the gecko got fired?
Yeah.
How stupid can these people be? That's like getting rid of the Aflac duck.
Well, now, the duck is on shaky ground, you know.
Well, you know who the duck is.
Yes, Wilford Brimley.
No. The duck is not Wilford. It's Gilbert Gottfried. The comic.
I was close.
Yeah. The Wilford Brimley is the guy who hawks diabetic products from Liberty Medical.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Okay. And apparently Wilford Brimley is a diabetic, or so he claims to be in the commercials. I'll take his word for it.
But is Gilbert Gottfried really a duck?
No. Gilbert Gottfried is the guy who told the greatest dirty joke in history. And I cannot repeat it on this program, but it was told at the 2001 Friar's Roast of Hugh Hefner, which was held 3 weeks after the attack on the World Trade Center.
Hmm.
We were all nuts about whether or not the roast should go on or not.
Yes.
And I remember when I was asked my opinion, not by anybody important, but just somebody at the club asked my opinion, So I said, what the heck? We all need something to laugh about. And let's do it. And there was Hugh Hefner in there with the Playmates and God knows what. And this was shown on Comedy Central, but I think they cut out the joke. Gilbert Gottfried got up, and it was near the end of the roast. He wasn't the closer. That usually is Corbett Monica or, there are another couple of guys who are closers at the roasts, and their names are escaping me at the moment, and if they're listening, I'll probably hear from their agents in the morning. But Gilbert Gottfried was bombing. Nobody was laughing at his stuff, and everybody who had got up before him was pulling punches, and they were saying nice things about Hugh Hefner. Now, Gilbert Gottfried didn't know Hugh Hefner from a hole in the wall. I mean, he knew he was head and founder of Playboy. But you know, he didn't know who Hugh Hefner, didn't know the guy. Gottfried Cambridge got up and spoke about Hugh Hefner being the first nightclub owner who would allow him to perform in a club that previously was considered restricted.
Yes.
He had him perform in the Playboy Club in New York City. And this was 1962 or 3, and Cambridge was extraordinarily grateful. He loved Hugh Hefner. You know, it came off as a love fest, but I got to tell you, he got off some of his best jokes not talking about Hugh Hefner at all. He kept talking about how there was a time when black people wanted to be like white people. And at the time, the average white family had 2.5 children. And he said, and my wife and I got 8 kids. We kept on trying to have that half baby. And then he talked about coming out from Los Angeles to New York for the roast. And he said, well, you know, all these restrictions on flying, they don't affect us black folks. We go Greyhound.
Well, I was also going to say that there's very few of the terrorists who have come across as black.
Well, not only that, I don't think any of them has, and I'll go you one further, because you are in El Paso, and as was pointed out by the Consul General of Mexico in New York,
yes,
some years ago to Univision. At the time, I was representing Univision. No terrorist has ever been apprehended crossing the border from Mexico into the United States. However, a number have been apprehended crossing the border from Canada.
Yes.
Okay. I don't think Mexico's a hotbed of terrorism. I think they're too busy having drug wars.
Well, there is that. At the same time, you know, since the Rio Grande, you can wade and not even get your knees wet. It's not the challenge it used to be for the terrorists. They like challenges.
I see. So, you know, they've given up the Mexico thing. They'd rather, you know, go to Portland, Maine and get on a plane to Boston and, you know, sneak through security in some backwater airport, and they're already in the system.
Exactly.
That kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. I can live with that. There is footage, and I don't know if you saw it, but there is footage of Mohammed Atta.
Yes.
The head guy of that 9/11 attack.
Yes.
Walking through the security cameras in Portland, Maine, got him. Walking through security at about 5 in the morning.
Yes.
To board a puddle jumper to Logan Airport.
Yes.
Where he boarded American Airlines Flight 11.
Yes.
And the security guard in Portland was literally asleep. I never heard of that guy being prosecuted.
Of course, because they're going to protect their own. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Heavens to Betsy. Well, Ken, until next week, and let's hope I have a better picture to discuss.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much, and it has indeed been a pleasure. And good night to all you out in Radio Land.
And until tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening. And well, guys, would you start my music, please?